This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. This week on the program, a panel of experts discusses how bad air reinforces existing inequities and how to craft policy that addresses environmental inequality. A recent study from Brigham Young University found that poor air quality decreased overall life expectancy for Utahns by 2 years. While data is not currently being collected on how dirty air plays into poor health, a proposed bill by Representative Stephen Handy would allow a medical examiner to include air pollution on a certificate of death if they believe it factored into the cause of death. Representative Handy claims this data would aid lawmakers in crafting more targeted and effective policies to address threats to public health and the environment. This week's panel discusses how existing pollution levels are already impacting the health and academic performance of low-income Utahns at disproportionate rates to those with higher income. The panel includes Daniel Mendoza, Research Assistant Professor in Atmospheric Sciences and Adjunct Assistant Professor in the Pulmonary Division at the School of Medicine at the University of Utah. Casey Mullen, Doctoral Student of Sociology at the University of Utah, and Senator Luz Escamilla, member of the Utah Legislature and the Air Quality Policy Advisory Board. Moderating today's discussion will be Ariel Clark Prophet, Sustainability Office Communications and Engagement Manager. This forum was put on in partnership with the Office of Sustainability. This forum was recorded on November 22, 2021. We will begin with Daniel Mendoza and his research into poor air quality in Salt Lake City.
Just want to give you a little bit of an overview of the work that I do, and I'm happy to take more discussion questions afterwards. So we want to be looking at indoor and outdoor air quality as environmental justice markers. And that's something that's important because we keep on thinking about outdoor air quality, but the reality is it's our indoor air quality that affects us the most. This is our 3i research team members. I always like to acknowledge them first, because without them, none of this work would be done. We have expertise ranging from political science, mining, artificial intelligence, epidemiology, also pulmonary medicine. This is, I always like to show this picture because it really highlights how much pollution we would be breathing in if it wasn't for, in my case, I'm fortunate enough to have air filters in my home, and you can actually see the differences in terms of what happens really 3 months afterwards during our poorer quality period. So this was done, this pretty much, I had put it in right before Thanksgiving and I cleaned it up and switched out the filters 2 months later. So how we want to develop equitable and inclusive environments, the way the model that I followed has been to either measure or model environmental exposure, then quantify the health impacts, calculate the economic cost, to then develop an actual public policy that will drive urban planning. It should be as simple as, should a road be developed near a school? Should a factory be moved, et cetera? And then we can kind of do the whole circle again to then look at what were the effects, or how can we model a much better new environment? Well, this is where the circle stopped for me until I started to really think about the fact that the burden of poor quality is not shared equally. And that's when I started to look at this through a lens of equity. Now we wanted to look at the air quality improving for all populations, specifically and particularly focused on the most vulnerable populations, the populations that may not even know this is affecting them, because while there are many people who are very well aware of the poor quality problems that we face here in the Wasatch Front, many people may not even know that and may not have the resources to ameliorate the situation. One of the major focus study areas for me has been Salt Lake County. And Salt Lake County, as you can see, is there's this great east and west divide where the west side has a lower population of white individuals, also lower amount of white collar workers, and a lower income overall. So this is part of what has driven a lot of our research. So this team that I highlighted, we've been working for over 3 years now. But one of our major success stories was really showing how these differences in COVID-19 positive cases were actually exacerbated by the lockdown that was enacted last spring. We can really see how, if we're looking at the lower income group and also the most diverse ethnic group, they ended up with 10 times the rate of COVID-19 positive cases. Many of the factors have to be with the fact that they work frontline jobs, are more exposed, have less protection, and live in multi-generational families. So this actually has brought to light some of what we had in terms of assumptions, but in fact are stark realities that differentiate the social demographic groups. Here was COVID-19, it was really a wake-up call. But again, another really quick example of this is really 4th of July fireworks. We've looked at multiple years of fireworks. Obviously, things were disrupted the past couple of years, but we can see here in Salt Lake City how, because the fireworks are located primarily on the west side, and ironically, not only are the fireworks creating hotspots there, but the clean air is coming in on the east side, as you can see on the bottom picture. That's downwind canyon flows from the Gresham Canyon, and it actually just pushes. So not only are the fireworks at that instant polluting the air, but they're also being compressed and are kept in those places on the west side primarily. And the residents there are exposed to this poor air quality for multiple hours. So many of our work pieces have really developed around looking at the exposure and indoor air quality. There's some elevated air quality events that we've looked at, inversions, dust storms, and fireworks, and also, unfortunately, the large amount of wildfires. So ultimately, and this is some work that I am assuming Casey's probably going to follow up, but we've looked at the educational outcomes, whether it's on test scores, whether it's on absenteeism. Differences really radically. The red line is more west side schools, the blue line is more east side schools, and we can see how the PM2.5, what we know as our inversion issues, they are significantly and almost twice as high as on the west side compared to the east side. Finally, when we're starting to look at this really elevated events, if all of you remember, August 6th, we had this huge dust event. We saw how it can even penetrate inside homes. The black line there is the outside. We've all heard of red air quality. Purple air quality is actually three times higher. And we could see how we had those events and it actually even permeated inside homes. Now, in terms of improving sort of our measurements here, particularly on the west side, we've started adding air quality sensors on electric buses, are primarily going on west side routes. And lastly, our last project has been looking at black carbon in schools. So there are two schools that we've been looking at. As you can see, school one has a little bit more in terms of events of poor air quality. We can see those spikes as the fossil fuel readings. We can see that it corresponds to the rush hours. Fortunately, so far, we are actually able to see that both schools are equally protective. You can see the y-axis is the indoor readings. Both schools are basically top off at around 800 nanograms per cubic meter, which is, it's not ideal, but it is much better than, for example, when you can see the X plot, which is the outdoor quality, which is can be up to three times higher in some of the schools. So what we're seeing is at least the buildings, the school buildings are protective of students. Many collaboration contributors, and this again, this work is really a product of all our really our energy into looking at social justice and environmental justice. So thank you.
If Casey, as we can say on this this research side.
All right, thank you also for inviting me. I'm really excited to be here. My name is Casey Mullen, and I am a doctoral candidate from the Department of Sociology. I study environmental sociology and environmental justice. Through my research with many collaborators, including Dr. Sarah Graneski, Timothy Collins, Carrie Kelly, and Dr. Daniel Mendoza, who's here today with us, we established the presence of environmental injustice in Salt Lake County with regard to air pollution exposure in schools. My first study local to Salt Lake County measured fine particulate matter pollutant levels at 174 Salt Lake County public schools during three distinct events. One, when the air quality was at concentrations under the National Ambient Air Quality Standards or on a relatively clean air day. Two, when the air quality was at moderate levels. And three, also when it was at its worst during a multi-day winter inversion. We found schools serving predominantly racial ethnic minority students were exposed to worse air pollution conditions during all three of the events that we examined. For my second study locally, which included Dr. Mendoza as a co-author, we first examined patterns of environmental injustice and found that schools serving predominantly racial ethnic minority and low-income students experienced worse air pollution, both in terms of annual averages and peak days of acute exposures. Then we examined the effect that the peak exposures had on third grade academic proficiency and found that more days of peak exposures were associated with higher percentages of third grade students testing below proficient in math and English language arts. These findings are important because peak pollution exposures like winter inversions are of particular concern here locally. And the peak pollution levels we utilized in our study were still under the US Environmental Protection Agency's standard. In Salt Lake County, we have found that our research connects social disadvantage and air pollution. They're very highly correlated. There is a significant presence of environmental injustice with regard to air pollution exposure for schools serving predominantly racial ethnic minority and lower income students that we really need to address. Currently, I'm working on my dissertation research, and the aim of my dissertation research is to assess the socio-spatial inequalities in the distribution of a non-governmental air quality monitoring network in Salt Lake County. So I am including Purple Air and AirU air pollution sensors in my analysis, and I will use those results to select local environmental justice communities of concern with sparse sensor coverage and recruit families with children with asthma to give air pollution sensors to. This will help expand the local network of air pollution sensors and also help us learn more about people's experiences with air pollution and air pollution sensing. Thank you.
Thank you, Casey. And Senator Escamilla, if you could tell us things that are going on at the state level to deal with these issues, that'd be wonderful.
Absolutely. And thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. It's always a pleasure to me to join multiple people in academia that are providing us with the data. And, you know, data is the power to, I guess, bring good public policy forward. So this context of having these conversations and really getting to learn more about the different studies that are taking place or research that's being done, it gives us and empowers legislators to run good public policy. So I had the pleasure to work with Dr. Mendoza for the last 4 years. And really been empowered with the information and data that he's been collecting. We've done some stuff together. So I guess one of the things I want to start with on the topic of this afternoon's, you know, panel is this idea that, you know, environmental justice or climate justice or whatever we want to call it, it doesn't happen in a vacuum. I mean, you really have to understand that for the general public, you know, it's as social determinants of health are hitting their lives, especially to low income and racial and ethnic minority communities. In our case, in the Salt Lake City area or Salt Lake County areas, the west side of Salt Lake, you know, it doesn't happen in a vacuum. There's certainly a pyramid of needs and people are fighting every day to survive. And certainly the pandemic was a really good example of how, you know, we knew it was going to disproportionately impact certain communities, and that happened immediately. And we saw the aftermath of that. So it really, when you think about environmental justice, the lens comes from all the different cultural identities of these individuals. And all of us as residents now, we know air quality does not discriminate based on race, religion, or where you live, but there is, because of social determinants of health, you can see how it impacts different areas. So I've been doing some, you know, work, and I'll just maybe a little bit of a story of how this started for me. You know, I live in Rose Park, so that's where I reside, and I've actually unfortunately developed asthma in the time that I've lived there. Never had that before, and developed asthma as an adult. And I know, you know, in very deep inside of me that certainly where I live is not helpful for my health. It changed a little bit when the last of our kids at the age of a couple of months old developed asthma as well. She's now a healthy 6-year-old, but for years we had to struggle with her breathing. And certainly bad air quality days were things that were a reality for our family as we were now, you know, looking into a 1-year-old baby or a 2-year-old baby and you know, having to to pump, and help her with her breathing and getting to her oxygen levels that she needed. So, it really, when it hits home, it changes a little bit of that dynamic. So, but what really got for me was in 2014, the state of Utah was having these really interesting conversations related to waste and waste in the North Salt Lake area. And a group of mothers came together, and they were, many of them, living in what you now call the Foxboro area in North Salt Lake. And they were seeing, and they were gathering their own data. I mean, this is why it's so important to understand why data is so critical. And their data was just based on their observations and outcomes related to their healthcare. Many of them related to the number of miscarriages that we're seeing. I know there was more information that came out of that, but they started talking about air quality and waste in that area. Now, keep in mind, when we talk about development and going back to what Dr. Mendoza presented in his PowerPoint, how he has his little, things of steps to get us through a process of how you create good public policy, we've been developing maybe 40 years ago when this company was, for example, in this case, one of the companies that was in violation of environmental laws, I mean, really drastically, there was nothing next to that. I mean, so development took place, housing was developed and schools were developed blocks away from that location, which, makes the question of what was the city thinking when they were doing that. And, who was behind, making this planning of these communities, right? And of course, when you move in there, maybe you don't think, oh, let me go and check in the radius of a mile what I have next to the housing. You're kind of like getting the housing that you can afford, right? Because of social determinants of health. Now housing is an issue of affordability, not necessarily what the best air quality is surrounding you. So I got to meet all these women, mostly women mothers, that came with these like serious concerns. And that's when I realized that in the state of Utah, so this is 2014, I run the first bill, SB 64, air quality rules and penalties. I realized that there's only one place in the whole Utah code that the statute of limitation is 1 year. And that is our environmental violation code and penalties. And it was shocking. I'm like, what do you mean? I mean, we do statute of limitations averaging in our code about 5 years. And all I wanted was 5 years, which is the average, right? And I thought, oh, this is pretty reasonable. Well, it was not reasonable. It was not reasonable for the industries. I can tell you that I was probably not in their favorite list of legislators for sure. And my bill died, and it was brutal. I mean, I'm not gonna lie, it was brutal. And I've been in the legislature for 13 years, and that was one of the most brutal battles. And I lost that battle in 2014. Came back on 2015, but one of the things that was a unique piece to this conversation was understanding how we, in the state of Utah, address penalties and how do we even know if there is a violation of our environmental laws. And that's actually self-reporting, number one. And you actually have to have an investigator come to your shop and kind of like, get your log of data and information that you're providing, self-reporting again. And we accepted as a state that our investigators could only do a rounds of on all the companies and industries once at a minimum 1.5 times a year, meaning even if our statute of limitation was 1 year and our investigators did the rounds, there was never a way to enforce because the statute of limitation was beyond that, right? So if you can only do a statute of limitations in 1 year and you were gathering data 1.5 times, meaning a year and a half that you can actually do the rounds in the companies. So that was triggering. And I continued the fight the following year on 2015. I was able to pass to SB 208, and that's the air quality amendment. So what I did, I was only able to increase. What we did is we increased civil penalties against the person who violates the Air Conservation Act and authorized DEQ to use a portion of penalty money for environmental remediation. We also increased the statute of limitations by 1 year, guys. So I'm sorry, I wanted the five, I could only get two. And, we actually moved that and we were able to get it to in the environmental quality code. So we were able to pass this piece of legislation and again, just little steps, right? And it's frustrating. Then I got to interact more with Dr. Mendoza, and we were able to work on monitoring data collection, which is part of the studies and work he's done. And we were able to get some ongoing appropriation funding so we can put monitors in the UTA tracks lines so we can get the data that he was explaining and really have an actual way of explaining the impact when you can make a correlation between, you know, like he was explaining, missing school days and children, right? Living on the East versus the West side. And just lastly, of course, I apologize, I'm taking a lot of time, but I don't want to dismiss the conversation of the inland port and why to, in my district, it's a top priority for any constituent that lives on the west side of Salt Lake City, that, you know, its impact will be and is already impacted as we move into implementation of the Utah Inland Port. So in that case, I oppose the inland port. I think it's in the worst location that you can put it, the inland port. I think if they would have put it 25 miles west, would have been a very different scenario versus where it is. And keep in mind, the inland port is not like just a location, meaning it's a port of entry situation and where you're going to have just traffic, right? I don't know that you're going to see like a side of people doing transactional stuff. It's mostly just traffic, but you're moving semis, tons of semis, and a lot of trains and other like large cargo situations. So the goal is, how do we electrify it? How do we make it more as less impactful? You will have an impact. Thousands of more semis will have an impact, whether it's noise pollution, water pollution, air pollution, of course, and other pieces. So the only thing I was able to make sure is we were able to get a, inland port, I was able to pass SB 144, which is the environmental quality monitoring amendments. And that basically directs DEQ to establish and maintain monitoring facilities to measure environmental impacts on water quality and air quality. And then later I passed legislation establishing the community enhancement program within the inland port to address the impacts of development in inland port to those communities that will be impacted disproportionately. So I say that because like I said, when I think about environmental justice and air quality, it's not on a silo conversation. It really needs to be as a more comprehensive, holistic way of seeing this impact. Thank you.
That was Senator Luz Escamilla, member of the Utah Legislature and the Air Quality Policy Advisory Board. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today, a panel explores local and global inequities around clean air. Here, again, is your moderator, Ariel Clark Prophet.
Senator Escamilla reminds us that air pollution does not discriminate. But we're still talking about environmental justice because there is discrimination that exists in our systems. And the title of this conversation today is Can You Afford Clean Air? And this reduces clean air, which is essential for our health and for our life, to a commodity. And that's just a really disturbing reality. So I want to ask our panelists, what should we consider when we're calculating the full cost of clean air?
Hey, I can jump in here. I think so. Again, I do want to really thank the legislators that I've worked with, Senator Escamilla, Representative Romero, Representative Mark Wheatley as well, who have actually really taken, and Representative Joel Briscoe, have really taken this issue of poor quality to heart, either because they do see themselves being affected, their family members or friends being affected, and, you know, have given my work some purpose. I think that when we start to look at our academic work, sometimes we're just mired into publishing papers and things like that and giving presentations. But what's most gratifying for me is being able to see the change. And in terms of really answering your question, I can just very quickly say that, unfortunately, it is clean air is a commodity. How do we must all know, friends, colleagues, who probably say, hey, I moved to Park City because I don't really want to deal with inversion here. And that's something that now it's almost become a luxury item, because if we think about how much more expensive it is to live either on the foothills on the East Bench, move to Park City, and then obviously some people that I know have moved to Heber Valley because that area is much less polluted. But what about the people who can't afford to do that? And then we have to start thinking about, well, what opportunities are there? I showed that filter picture, which I always like to kind of, it's sort of like the wow picture. It's sort of showing how much air or how much pollution could really be going into our lungs if we don't have an air purifier. And I mean, I'm fortunate that I live closer to the U, which is one of the cleaner areas, but still that air pollution would still be going to my lungs. I mean, I don't know if I should be cleaning out my filter more often. I mean, I do some measurements. Luckily, I do have access to sensors, but not everyone does. So I think that one phrase that struck me was one of my mentors, Dr. Rob Payne. He coined this phrase of the burden of poor quality is not shared equally. And that's something that we need to really think about. And it's unfortunate that not only is it more costly, but it also, it's the communities that know the least, that are least informed, that are actually suffering the worst. And that's something that we really need to start thinking about, because one of the issues here is the education component, is knowing, for example, that you maybe you're already in a more polluted area. How else can you start protecting yourself more or protect your family more? And that's really kind of the thrust of this. It's not just necessarily cleaning up the air, which we all want to do, but if you're already in a situation like this, provide the education so the communities that are on most risk. And perhaps it is a language issue. We do know that communities where English is not the first language typically take about three to seven years more than communities whose first language is English to even be aware of the problem. So that's something that's of great interest to us.
So I have prepared a discussion on the costs of air pollution exposure and some factors that impact access to clean air. But of course, my list is by no means exhaustive. I'm committed to learning through community members, students, and professionals each and every day. So if anyone would like to contribute to this discussion further, I encourage you to do so. So to begin with, one of the costs of air pollution is that it causes cognitive harm, and this reduces human capital of whole societies. Anthropogenic pollution causes neurological damage, which stands to negatively impact societal development. Population level impairment can reduce the intelligence and productivity of generations, undermining developmental trajectories of entire societies. Studies have found that exposure to pollution, including particulate matter and hazardous air pollutants, is associated with lower IQ. Prenatal exposures to industrial chemicals have been associated with children's IQ losses of between 4 to 5 points. Air pollution exposures are associated with health effects ranging from premature mortality and asthma to autism spectrum disorder and Alzheimer's. Sensitive groups like people with asthma or other respiratory struggles are especially vulnerable to air pollution. So whether it's kids that are chronically absent from school or adults missing work, their experiences with respiratory struggles have negative impacts on their life, including, but certainly not limited to, their education and their capacity to earn an income. And importantly, as we've addressed, these effects are not distributed evenly. So locally, we live in a mountainous valley that contributes to our fluctuating air quality. When cold air settles in the Salt Lake Valley, high pressure weather systems act like a lid and seal in particulate matter pollution. And elevation matters with respect to that. So the lowest elevations experience higher concentrations of fine particulate matter and for the longest time, which I think Dr. Mendoza touched on earlier. This impacts residential communities disproportionately. And with respect to race and ethnicity, we must consider socio-historical processes like racial segregation, housing discrimination, redlining, unequal resource allocation, and environmental racism. You may have heard that one of the best predictors of health is zip code. And there are many American cities that are segregated along socioeconomic lines. In Salt Lake County, we absolutely have neighborhoods with higher proportions of people of color in comparison to other neighborhoods, particularly on the northwest quadrant of Salt Lake County. And without a doubt, some of these socio-historical processes have played a role in making these neighborhoods. Air pollution affects people of color and low-income communities disproportionately across the nation, often because there are more polluting sources located in proximity to those communities. So in Salt Lake County, we have to consider the locations of some of our industrial activity, right? The airport, mining activity, refineries, the landfill, and like Senator Escamilla mentioned, the incoming inland port. Also, locations of major roadways and railways and even construction and development contribute to our fluctuating air quality. Dr. Sarah Graneski and Timothy Collins conducted a research locally on social inequalities and exposures to pollution for people of all ages in the Salt Lake Metropolitan Statistical Area. And they found that neighborhoods with higher proportions of Hispanic, Black, and Pacific Islander residents had significantly higher levels of air pollution. Age is another important factor to consider. Children are more vulnerable to the negative impacts of air pollution exposure than adults due to their small body stature, growing lungs, and developing brains. And children spend a great deal of their day at school. If the school is located in an area that experiences worse air pollution on average, they cannot escape that. Of course, income impacts access to healthcare and the quality of care that is accessible. It also impacts a person's ability to engage in individual level preventative measures, like Dr. Mendoza was mentioning. So buying and regularly replacing the appropriate air filters for your home, which are more expensive, buying household air purifiers to keep your indoor air clean, the ability to afford household air quality sensors so that you can know in near real time what your air pollution exposure is like in your home or in your neighborhood, buying the right face mask to filter bad air, and the list goes on. Air pollution impacts everyone negatively, but we see various methods of dealing with air pollution exposure at the individual level, and these methods are not equally attainable. So in summary, these all contribute to creating a cumulative impact, and the impacts are disproportionate. In this way, air pollution or clean air becomes a luxury for some. And if we're calculating the true cost of clean air, we can see that currently it takes various elements of privilege, and it doesn't have to be that way. We can work towards shaping our cities in such a way to decrease the amount of pollution we are creating. We can work toward protecting each and every person from air pollution exposures equally. Decreasing air pollution exposure in areas of concern benefits everyone in the region. And everything I've mentioned up to this point is related to social factors. And so we have the ability to make social change that can help us work toward ensuring clean air for all, a healthy environment for everyone improves everyone's quality of life, and everyone has the right to breathe clean air. As far as addressing the issue, expanding the network of air quality sensors is one way of addressing unequal exposure to air pollution that I'm familiar with, as well as Dr. Mendoza. This enhances our understanding about the variability in our local air quality. Many people are working toward expanding the air quality network here. And by adding more air pollution sensors around our valley, we can observe better through space and time what the air quality is really like and at a finer scale at the neighborhood level. This can help us pinpoint areas of greatest concern. And in addition to improving the data on air quality that we have, we can work toward empowering community members' voices and validating their lived experiences by presenting air quality data to community members and leaders for their feedback and approval. We can allow residents to act as the local experts and collaborators that they really are, rather than as subjects or volunteers in research. And including the expertise of community members provides further history, context, and impact. Air pollution data should serve community initiatives toward the solutions that they feel are necessary, as well as inform policymakers, planners, and other community leaders to create a healthy and sustainable community and protect everyone equally.
Senator Escamilla, did you have anything to add, or should we go on to the next question?
Please.
All right, great. I will actually ask this question first to you, Senator Escamilla, but based on our discussions so far, vulnerable populations, ranging from kids to elderly on fixed income to unborn children, and to those who can't afford things like healthcare, which I know is near and dear to your heart, Senator Escamilla. Those are the people with the highest risk for poor health outcomes in response to air pollution. So this is true globally, but this is definitely true in Utah and in Salt Lake City, as we're hearing today. So what policies and research are needed to make sure we're implementing equitable solutions?
You know, I think there's multiple legislation that's moving. It all has a price tag attached to it. And, you know, it's exciting to hear what's happening. There's some interesting proposals coming for this next legislative session. I'm one of the co-chairs of the Clean Air Caucus, and which is the only bipartisan caucus in the state legislature. I believe been effective under the circumstances, which is, you know, when you have too much power in one group, you know, it's just hard to bring some equity and justice and balance on decision-making process. So that's always a challenge if you're part of the minority party, and if the communities are disproportionately impacted, as described by both speakers before, they tend to be represented by members of the minority party, then you have this disconnect, right? And I think that's unfortunate. But the reality is there are some opportunities with some of the injection of the federal money coming our way on infrastructure, not only through the plan that was just signed, you know, by President Biden, but also the fact that we've had hundreds of millions of dollars that through the CARES Act and ARPA money have been injected to our economy. So we're going to see like this extra set of revenue, which is considered a one-time money that I think could be injected into some infrastructure. I am personally running a very aggressive reduction emissions plan program, very similar to what Texas has done, and mostly, you know, trying to bring some intervention pieces. So you have prevention, intervention, and then like the massive crisis that could need some help. Obviously, funding work that is being done by, as an example, you know, I always use Dr. Mendoza's work because it's very, you're able to bring some, to quantify some of the outcomes on that. But again, one of the biggest challenge again is, you know, I go back to this idea of how do you get people engaged? How do you get them to care about this when they're thinking how they're going to feed their family this evening, right? And you're talking about air quality, which is even a more difficult concept, even though it may be affecting their quality of life. They may be coughing, they may be getting sick and having, you know, issues related to asthma or so forth, but they can't even think about asthma because they don't have health insurance to go and see a doctor. They don't have a way to pay their rent. So how do we connect this so people actually engage? You know, it's always a challenge. And now gentrification will bring a very, it's probably going to bring a different dynamic pretty soon here, especially in Salt Lake City. So when you say, can you afford, you know, the air quality situation, I'm like, well, just wait until gentrification. I mean, as gentrification continues to happen, which, you know, I think it's horrible and is breaking a lot of great communities, especially on the west side of Salt Lake City, but affordability and housing will bring gentrification. It's happening already. You're going to start seeing maybe some people that may actually care and have some access to power and be able to, you know, maybe their income bracket will allow them to engage at a different level, or their education, like Dr. Mendoza was saying, you know, to access individuals that are making decision-making, lawmakers or others, you know, that would change that dynamic. At the end of the day, you know, when you look at the social determinants of health, and that's mostly the lens that I approach everything that I do in terms of policy, it really then addresses those inequalities and inequities. It's, we are still behind, especially on air quality when it comes to our area. You think about, for example, other parts of the country where they're still struggling with water, the drinkable water, right? You know, and it's sad that you're thinking, well, the most powerful country in the world cannot get air quality and water taken care of for their residents. But I think there will be some money. So that infrastructure money, let's put our money where our mouth is. Let's demand from the legislature that, and look, if you ask, depends who you're asking, but if you ask certain individuals in the legislature, they'll tell you, hey, our air quality is better now than it was 60 years ago, if I hear that again. And it's like, oh, wow, that's a threshold from 60 years ago. Like, I mean, we then move into a tier 3 conversation. Yeah, but not everything that's in Utah that is being utilized is tier three. I mean, because then you get into the credits and, you know, these other pieces. Well, then we move into incentivizing programs, right? And those are the interventions I'm talking about. So yeah, now we have the CARAT program where we incentivize people to get rid of their, you know, certain type of vehicles or others that may be polluting more. Well, let's put more into those incentive programs, which will be my emission reduction program plan. That requires money. Let's put the money there. The inland port, man, we better get it right, right? I mean, if we, with all the information that we have, with all the monitoring that we're doing now, with $50 million that the federal government gave to USU to bring, you know, to electrify it as much as we can on the inland port, that inland port better be the best inland port in the world. Because if not, then we, right? And that's the scary part. Like, what are the chances? I'm sure there's going to be a lot of mistakes. Let's just keep an eye on them. Let's educate people in a way they can understand so they can engage at a level that they feel comfortable, because it is about their future and their kids' future and their grandkids' future, right? I mean, this is a long-term, guys. I mean, we may be okay. We, like the ones that are right now participating on this panel, but our kids and our grandkids and our great-grandkids, they're going to have a very different scenario.
Yeah, absolutely. And the air quality might be better than it was 60 years ago, but we also know a lot more about how that impacts our health.
Yeah, no, please, I need to take you when, if I hear that comment again. Yes, it happens sometimes.
Take Dr. Mendoza or Casey, they are the experts on the research side. So the air quality problems in Salt Lake, as we've talked about, they're not happening in a vacuum. As we saw this past summer, the wildfires in the West led to Salt Lake's air crisis. Air pollutants contribute to climate change, but climate change also contributes to air pollution. So what compounding effects from climate change can Utah prepare for now to protect its communities? And Dr. Mendoza, I know you have some interesting feedback on this, so I'll turn it to you.
Yeah, I think that we need to really start thinking about, as you just mentioned, that these air quality issues do not really happen in a vacuum. Now, air quality is a more localized phenomenon, but climate change is a more general phenomenon. And as we saw, most of those wildfires were not really originated in Utah. They were from other more Western states. And I think that what we need to really think about is working together with across the US and with other countries as well. These wildfires, again, they are a result of our changing climate, drier, hotter summers, and even warmer winters. We may have all seen in the news how almost all of the ski resorts this year have postponed their openings 1 to 2 weeks simply because of just a change that we're seeing. So what we really need to be very aware of is that, again, while our air pollution does cause issues in a more local level, it does eventually drive some of the climate change, which then impacts everywhere, the entire world. Some of the really most drastic events, and that's something you just touched on, Arrow, is the wildfire proliferation. One of the figures that I scrolled through just showed how bad the wildfires can be. That August 6th event, we couldn't really see outside our homes, and we could actually smell. It was almost like we had a cookout inside our homes, and that is a really dramatic problem. Again, when we look at climate change, we also have to think about such impacts as just as drought that we are experiencing right now. The Great Salt Lake, I just saw a terrifying statistic that it has dropped 8 inches from August till early November. It's dropped 8 inches. And what that's doing, it's also exposing lake bed, which then is exposing heavy metals. We know that's a huge concern, particularly for the Northwest Quadrant, because those heavy metals will travel much less than, for example, the PM or the ozone or any of these other contaminants. That's going to directly affect those neighborhoods in that area by the inland port. So we need to really start thinking about what are these impacts and how can we start to mitigate them. Now, Utah cannot change or cannot stop climate change on its own. We can't do that. But this is a joint effort that needs to happen across other countries, across other states. And that's something that we really need to start to consider. And unfortunately, some of the work that we're doing, that Casey's been doing, Dr. Skrzydnewski and Collins have also been doing, is really starting to quantify what is the monetary cost or what are real indicators that we can actually take to the state legislature. What, for example, when we look at student absences or lower standardized test scores, that can be monetized. And that's something that we can say, look, this is the cost of inaction. If we do nothing to stop this train, this is going to happen to the generations following us and for us as well. So that's something that we really need to be putting into consideration when we start to discuss all of this compounding impacts.
That was Daniel Mendoza, Research Assistant Professor in Atmospheric Sciences and Adjunct Assistant Professor in the Pulmonary Division at the School of Medicine at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this segment, the panel answers questions from the virtual audience. Once more, here is your moderator, Ariel Clark Prophet, Sustainability Office Communications and Engagement Manager.
So the first question that I have from the audience, is it possible for policy to use competition in the market to drive down pollutants by using fee revenue to remediate all of the added healthcare costs and environmental impact from air pollution?
I am not especially informed on this, but I know there is a University of Utah student who did quantify the amount of money that we would save, I think, by expanding healthcare access to people in Salt Lake County. And it was like they compared the costs on our healthcare system without having everyone have access to healthcare, and like thinking about air pollution and how it exacerbates respiratory issues. And they ran numbers and discovered that we actually would save money if everyone had access to healthcare in that regard. And I wish I remembered their name. I will work on finding out the student's name.
Other thoughts regarding that as a policy, as a market-driven solution?
I mean, we incentivize, right? I mean, so incentives is kind of like the carrot versus a stick approach, and just based on our political climate in the state of Utah, mandates are not very popular. And, you know, market-driven solutions seems to what people like to say. I sometimes don't necessarily agree that those are the best approaches, but the emissions program that I'm working on is mostly incentivized-driven, so all incentive-driven, most of it. But I also think you need some enforcement mechanisms. I mean, when your fine is pennies to what you're making, you'll pay the fine. And we've seen that with a lot of, you know, violators and polluters, where they almost laugh of those fines. And that's frustrating. So, I mean, I like the idea of competition and market driven. But at one point, you know, it's all kind of like relative to the type of, industries that we're talking about, I guess.
Absolutely. So the next question that came in from the audience was, if pollutant contributions are self-reported, that seems to be a conflict of interest. Would it be feasible to make industry justify being charged less than a max standard fee through self-reporting?
You know, it was the same concept. I mean, the question is, in terms of enforcement, is the infrastructure that you need to enforce something. And, you know, we see it in law enforcement as well. Right? So the people are speeding. You know, I mean, if we were to actually ticket every speeder out there, you know, there will be a lot of tickets, but you don't have enough, you know, police officer or highway patrol officers to do that. It's the same when we have this issue. And yeah, it's unique into the self-reporting. And by that, I mean, so they're, you know, my understanding is not like they're making up the numbers, like writing them on a piece of paper, like there's somehow a way of that, but where they could be, you know, change or, you know, alter, I guess. But it seems to be the standard of how this thing happened. I mean, I was kind of like shocked. I'm like, okay, wait, what do you mean? Say what? I think in the case, for example, we've had this very public case of that, the waste and the way we were handling waste. This was actually medical waste out of all things. And that was, and this, they were burning the medical waste, and that was creating this massive problem. you know, and the public was driving a lot of that. I mean, public shame is very powerful, guys. So I mean, as we're having this conversation of a more law enforcement legislative approaches, I've learned that public shame is equally heavy and you know, and sometimes drives changes faster than some of the legislative changes. Not that it takes away from the responsibility of good public policy at our legislative levels, for example, but you know, it's another idea to consider. I mean, if we start demanding and we start consuming, you know, products or services from companies that are responsible, I think that also makes a big difference.
Yeah. And we have to understand that as well, that self-reporting is not necessarily, as Senator Scamia just said, no one's just writing things down. There are, factories and industry have to go through a process. They have to specify what their actual activity is, and they have to specify how much of a certain product they are actually processing. That is all found through, for example, tax records, certifications, annual certifications. So we can't just say, oh, they're just self-reporting. That means that they're not necessarily being formally audited, but they have to do this. It's almost like how we're doing our taxes, right? Some people can get away with it, but the reality is that most industry really is, they're trying to do the right thing.
Good clarification. All right, we have one last question that's come in from the audience that I think we have time for, but we'll have to be brief. What is the best way for citizens or maybe people at the University of Utah, given our audience, to become engaged in this debate and push forward good policy?
I'll jump really fast. I think, you know, I get this question all the time on multiple issues, right? Redistricting a week and a half ago, which we're still dealing with PTSD from that. But one of the things I think that's critical is people say, well, I live in Salt Lake City, my legislators get it, you know, and maybe some of them were mentioned before, and that's great. Well, then you may have family in Utah County or Davis County where you have other legislators that may be not there. And you, I mean, that commitment is, can you call five people that you know that are not in your district to connect with their legislators? If you're already connected with your legislator, you're already there. If you know your legislator, if you even know who your legislator is, you're like, you know, 50% into how, you know, where we need you to be. But getting the five other people to do it, I mean, it's like, this is a number issue. Let's just get our numbers together. Let's bring awareness. So if you're committed to saying five more people that I will, in my circle, in my universe, that are not maybe in my district, that I can, you know, talk to them and say, hey, can you connect about this issue? Find a bill. You know, you can track us at le.utah.gov. We have a great tracking system on legislation. And please just visit also our Cleaner Caucus's Facebook Live every Tuesday of every month. The third Tuesday of every month, we're meeting and, you know, talking about these issues. You can watch us on Facebook and watch what we're talking about and follow those bills. Thank you.
Great. Any last advice, Casey, Dr. Mendoza?
I think it's just becoming educated and then just realizing again that, as Senator Scamia just said, that public shame can actually be a significant driver. So if there's a group of concerned citizens, a group of concerned people that want to try to make a change, work with your elected representatives. That's what you elected them for, so they can represent you. But then also make sure you if you are interested and you do have good points and you do have the basis for it, make sure your concerns are heard.
That's our show. If you'd like to hear other Hinckley Forums, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.